The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Mark talks about async, testimony, and desync. Joe goes too slow to know to keep up. ELN finishes out the year with a wild affair. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This is your last chance to sign up for the Enterprise Leadership Network's November Executive Forum. It will be held next Monday and Tuesday, November 13th and 14th at the Monterey Plaza Hotel. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity to talk to and meet with top executives about issues of cybersecurity, electronic discovery, and more. Be there along with many other top flight folks from around the country and beyond. To sign up, go to eln3.com. See you there.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. Calls for responsible artificial intelligence are coming out all over the world. People everywhere are asking for explainable AI. However, those same people are not willing to explain their own statements. News outlets worldwide are not able to explain why their images are different from the words they claim about those images. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show.
This is your last chance to sign up for the Enterprise Leadership Network's November Executive Forum. It will be held next Monday and Tuesday, November 13th and 14th at the Monterey Plaza Hotel. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity to talk to and meet with top executives about issues of cybersecurity, electronic discovery, and more. Be there along with many other top flight folks from around the country and beyond. To sign up, go to eln3.com. See you there.
How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Well, the fraudsters are certainly listening to the show. And now we have an update on a standard fraud you should all know about by now. It's the classic, we'll give you a lot of money if you give us a little. But in this case, there appears to be an actual human on the other end. You should not do what I'm doing, but I do it every once in a while just to see how it plays out. In this case, there's an email thread from somebody claiming to be Steve Bradner, UN. Now, here's how it starts.
Dear Fred Cohen, I trust this message finds you in good health. Attached herewith, you will find the bank confirmation letter along with your soft copy of the cashier's check, which is fully verifiable by your bank. This check has received approval for payment. However, until HSBC Bank dispatches the hard copy and sends MT-110 to your bank, you will be unable to access the full cash amount in your personal account, even after depositing the check. You may request your bank to verify the authenticity of this check based on the soft copy provided. We wish to inform you that you will need to facilitate the courier delivery of the hard copy to your home address or bank along with the associated fees for the MT-110 SWIFT to your bank. Please note that you can print out this soft copy of the cashier's check and confirm its value with your bank. The delivery of this check and associated fees will cost you a total of $870, $870 only. Thank you for your cooperation. Best regards, Steve Bradner.
Now, this particular fraud includes an actual copy of what looks like it could be a certified check. It's for a very large amount of money, millions of dollars, and it's made out to me. I suspect they're using AI to generate these checks because they do have my name on it and other similar information, but they might just be using a graphical editor to drop in the name and so forth onto what looks like a standard check. There are two sides to it. I didn't even look at the other side. As I said, the amount of money is very substantial, and it looks like it might be, you know, taken from a scan of an actual HSBC bank check. It does have a whole bunch of small writing on it. That's sort of the micro writing that you see when you scan or copy a check. And so it's not actually looking like it's a fraud, but clearly it must be a fraud because who would send you millions of dollars if you just send them almost 1,000? The answer is nobody legitimate. So I emailed back, thank you. I don't accept money except in payments for some value I return. Once you provide further details, I will arrange for my account representative at HSBC Bank to get the cashier there to process the funds internally so as to eliminate the need for these fees. After it is processed, I will be happy to send you 50% of those fees in appreciation for your facilitating this transaction. Please provide your bank details so I can wire the money to you once the transaction is completed. And of course, I signed it FC.
Dear Fred Cohen, thanks for your email. Since you cannot accept such check to your name, we will have to cancel payment to you. Thanks for your understanding. Regards, Steve Bradner.
Now, one of the problems with these automated responses to these elicitations of various sorts is every once in a while they get it wrong. It looks like this was a manual intervention. There was a typo in the middle of it and so forth that I fixed so you could hear it right. But the real key is that I had another automated email from them, the same Steve Bradner automation of some sort, and I'll now tell you what that one said.
Dear, I hope this message finds you well. I've been eagerly awaiting your response regarding your pending transaction. It appears that you may have encountered some challenges securing the associated fees for your required documents. Considering the delay in securing the necessary clearance documents for the transfer to your bank account, we are left with limited options. We understand that circumstances can be difficult, but it's essential to ensure the successful completion of your inheritance contract payment. If we do not receive confirmation of your commitment to securing the required documents within this week, we may need to consider cancelling and closing your transaction. We genuinely want to assist you in claiming your funds, but we require your cooperation to move forward. Please let us know your intentions and the progress regarding the clearance documents as soon as possible to avoid any further delays or complications. Warm regards, Steve Bradner.
So there you have it. A standard fraud, but they screwed up by sending two different responses to my same response to them. In fact, the last one you heard didn't even have my name in it, so the automation screwed up even worse. But that's just how it goes. The innovation of having a realistic-looking check with a big number on it and with my name on it, that certainly is worthwhile. But still, as a fundamental, always remember when somebody says, here's a whole bunch of money, all you have to do is give me your money first, the answer should always be no. Actually, you should never even bother to answer it. Just put it in the junk box and don't worry about it again. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. So how do you create a phony but realistic looking check? It's easy enough. All you have to do is scan in a real check. You can do this by taking a photograph with your smartphone or using a flatbed scanner. In fact, you can also find images of checks on the internet if you just look for them. For this sort of fraud, you don't have to worry about getting it right for two reasons. First, the quality of the check doesn't have to look very good because the fraudster is only claiming that it's a scanned copy, not an original. Second, the person looking at the check is probably not looking with the eyes of a questioned document examiner. They're more likely looking with the eyes of a person wanting the money. The second step involves using a graphical image manipulation program. I prefer the program called GIMP, which is GNU Image Manipulation Program, but you can use anything you like. However, for modern frauds at high volume, the substitution of names requires automation. Fortunately, for the fraudsters, you can use command line interfaces and write small programs to insert the name, which is the only thing unique about the checks required, and you can do this fully automatically. This segment is called How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. And that's how you do that.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. For more details, become a member at enterprisemindset.com.
ELN will have a forum at the Monterey Plaza Hotel on November 13th and 14th of this year. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co and click on the link to ELN. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
But, we had fun in D.C., so.
Well, you know, there's nothing that quite compares in my experience to testifying, and that's a very strange court to testify in because the direct examination doesn't exist. You write your report, and they only cross-examine you on it.
Correct.
So I found that to be fascinating. So, but I didn't have to remember all the stuff that I was going to say when they asked me all the questions they were going to ask me because that's the hardest thing I have is trying to remember what questions I'm going to be asked and how to answer them. It's easy to tell the truth in the sense of, you know, saying what you believe you know, but it's actually quite difficult to carefully speak the truth so as to not leave any misimpressions.
Yeah, you have to be careful. And for me, I do court a lot. I enjoy it. I know my space when I go in there. And in that particular case, I knew my space. And I had one of those fun moments when the opposing attorney asked me, you know, it doesn't sound like you guys make a lot of money at all at this. And I said, well, that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, your company hasn't made a dollar since it got started. At least that's what you tell everybody. And that was Guidance Software, and they had always reported a loss all the time. So I thought it was interesting. He was asking me, you know, do you really exist if you don't make any money?
I thought the more interesting thing, you know, when there was an error in my report, which they found and brought out, and they were doing that thing where you lead up to that seminal point that you're going to make. And I spotted as they led up to it, I spotted what they were talking about. So I had, you know, a couple milliseconds to figure out what I was going to say, which was basically, oh, yes, that was a mistake. Here's the correction. But even if my answer was correct, it wouldn't change anything in terms of the culture. And watching the guy's face, you know,
you were sitting behind the bench with your attorneys, right? But I'm looking at the attorney who's asking me the questions and watching his face as my answer came out. He turned ashen. I and that's the fun part of testifying is when you tell the truth in a manner that causes the other guy to just say, "Oh crap," I've been set up.
I was sitting there with the attorney, and he saw what was about to happen. And we're looking at you up there testifying, and my attorney used that little four-letter expletive, like, oh. And I said, I said to him, I said, "Relax," because I saw your face, and you were there. Yeah. It wasn't going to be an issue, and you got using them, and I wish I could have seen his face. When you did
that, I got to see his face, so it was worthwhile. That's all I can say. Didn't help at the end, same results. All right, good. Let's move on to something else.
So, Chris, it's those small things in life.
Yes, it's those small things in life, isn't it?
In some sense, I feel bad that I enjoyed the pain of the attorney working for the large corporation that never made any money, that told the judge that small corporations that don't make any money or haven't made any money should not be treated well, whereas big corporations that have lost lots of money should be treated well. So I don't feel that guilty about it, but still, on a human to human basis, it was fun. I admit it.
Well, most Americans out there have learned at least a little German in the last couple of years, because Schadenfreude, is a pretty common word. I remember when somebody first wrote it out for me.
All right, hang on. What does that word mean?
Schadenfreude is a German word meaning the enjoyment of somebody else's suffering, right? Ah. And it's like most things, you put it in social context, and it's just wonder. It's what you're just describing is this wry smile. It's not hatefulness. It's just stepping back and saying, "All right, you walked into that, and frankly, I don't mind." feel for your buddy as a person. However, that's you doing that, and I'm just gonna sit here and eat a hot dog and watch the entertainment.
So now, Chris, we've known each other for quite some time, and you have a streak about you that is occasionally, I will say, not as pleasant and nice and friendly as it might be. Generally, only applied to people that well deserve it.
Thank you. I try to be selective. Well, it's best to save it up. Well, security, in context and in business and so forth, don't reduce your effort. It's easier, better, more fun, more efficient, better, faster, cheaper to be nice. And if you really have to be unpleasant to someone, make sure you pick them, well, and be appropriately unpleasant. That may be real unpleasant.
Somebody that deserves it. Okay, so why don't you share with us a story that's relevant with regard to cyber about somebody that you worked with, and we won't name the company or the time and date, or if you would want to, you could, who decided to get you and, maybe at the RSA show or something like that, and you got them back.
Just take this one. I think I can make this anonymous enough. It was a large corporation, and a middle management person came in who was, frankly, just not really good at their job and incompetent and whatnot, which I can forgive, but did some really unethical things. I didn't like those at all. One of them was firing me, but it wasn't the fact that I got fired. That happens, a big corporation. It was just downsizing, cutting, changing priorities. A bunch of us got fired, but it was the way it was done.
Hang on, Chris. When you say fired you were still working there after he fired you.
Well, so the way it was done, it was five of us, and there's three of us got really, were the big paid folks, and two of us weren't. So three of us, the big paid people, got 2 weeks notice. The ones who weren't got 4 weeks notice, because 3 weeks from then there was a big annual bonus coming in. And the person in question wanted to take that bonus money and give it to some friends he wanted to hire. And look, I can live with that too. But, the two other folks who got fired with me, who'd lost that, significant bonus, one included somebody who'd just come out of, 25 years in the service. It was their first big paying private sector job, had a, wonderful family. This was a real, made a difference in their, to someone who deserved it. It deserved that bonus, a big chunk of money for that family would have been great. And the fact that this person did that so glibly and didn't pay attention to it. Anyways, it's just a stack of problems. So as you say, I unfired myself, so I was still there. And I did a range of things over the next year, including photobombing senior executive meetings and so forth in, you know, in foreign countries, so that the next time he fired me, he would get fired for it. And a year later, he fired me again. He got fired, and I got fired again.
When you say photobombing, explain to the people what that is, because there's a technique that's very important to learn and understand about how to, we'll say, affect change.
Well, so, okay, so one morning, you know, an early morning person, and there was an annual corporate executive get-together. You know, there's like 500 of the top people getting together, this huge conference center, and I'm walking in there early in the morning. I smell coffee, but before they're just putting out the coffee service, so it's not ready yet, but there's coffee somewhere. So I followed the smell down the side passage and found these two, you know, conference, you know, venue employees standing there guarding the door, which was open, and I could see the chairman of the board and the president and other, you know, C-levels folks, other people, 15, 16 people in a room with a coffee service. And when I walked up, one of the guys said, sorry, this is private, you know, are you invited here? So I walked past him, put my bag on the ground, got something out of it. He asked me a couple more times, you know, say, hey, you know, he's getting a little aggressive. So I completely ignored him, picked my stuff up, got it together, turned around and said two things. One, that's our chairman in there, so shh. Second, yes. Turned and just walked into the room, got a coffee, sat down at one of the round tables, and then interjected the chairman and I had been overseas together with a large utility client. And I added a follow-up question to the chairman, was giving a talk at that point, you know, to a partner, an executive from a partner company. So you know, in a couple of days later, I was walking in the hallway, and I saw the chairman, and I said, hey, you know, sorry for, you know, jumping into your meeting there, but I just smelled the coffee. And the chairman looked at me and said, you weren't supposed to be in that room. And I said, no, I just coffee. There's smelled coffee. And he put his hand on my shoulder and said, whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. Right. So it's, I guess if there's a lesson in there anywhere, it's like, just be authentic, do the right thing. Yeah. But be wise about it. Right. I know I'm barging into an executive meeting, but I know these people, I've worked with them before. And I spent the time, you know, making the entrance and sat quietly and added value to the conversation.
And had a coffee.
And had a coffee. Needed the coffee. It was early.
There's another component to that I think is fundamental and really important. And that is, there are a lot of people who believe or view their position as making them better than other people. And fundamentally, you know, that's a big problem with the world. The notion that somehow you're better because you're higher up in the hierarchy. No, I understand, you know, if I'm having a meeting with somebody with an objective and we're trying to get from here to there and you're in there interfering with it, well, that's not a good thing to do. And it's a problem for me. But on the other hand, I shouldn't treat you as if you're pawn scum, right? You're a person, you deserve to be treated with humanity. And by the way, there are lessons in this for the world today, obviously. But, you know, it's just this whole idea of superiority of one person or other. There's what's the name of that musical, Oklahoma, right? There's a great line from Oklahoma.
I'd like to teach you all a little saying and learn the words by heart the way you should. I don't say I'm no better than anybody else, but I'll be danged if I ain't just as good.
You get the idea.
I get the idea. Well, right, you know, and this is the way you can tell the system's corrupted, right? Because in a you know, everything's relative. There's no perfect systems, but in a generally functioning system, you know, a lot of the people and organizations, you know, who really are all that, have all that power and authority or expertise or whatever, are actually fairly reasonable, right? And in a corrupted system, you find out that, you know, organizations and individuals can get in those positions without having merit, right? And it to me, it feels like a badly built mechanical, you know, linkage, right? It's slop and grit in the gears, you know, the pin's going through a hole that's not the right size and slopping all over the place. It's inefficient and ineffective. So, you know, I honestly believe, you know, that Yeah, honesty, transparency. And if you're trying too hard, you know, the individual I was picking on there that I, you know, I think justifiably set up to nuke himself. You know, I don't particularly wish him unwell, but, you know, he's on a path that's not being useful. You're trying too hard, right? You know, there's a role for everyone. Just don't. Anyways, I don't know where I'm going with that, but yeah, that's where, you know, all of this, you know, I'm better than you is a weakness. You know, you may as well just say I'm terrified as, and I really don't feel very comfortable, and I'm going to keep acting like this because I can't. I'm not good in my own skin. Right. Anyway, sounds very cliche to say it out loud, but it's just literally true. Right. You may as well say I don't have any confidence.
Well, people driven by fear or hatred, I think, have no good place in the world. But I don't think there's any pure system. I don't think that you can have a system that isn't corruptible or corrupted. But it's a constant struggle, right? That is, to some sense, it's the job of you know, all good people to come to the aid of their country. I think, you know, it's a not exact quote, right? But yeah, we should all be seeking to help the world become a better place. And those that seek to make it a worse place for others, to make it a better place for themselves, it's not that I wish them ill, but I wish they would stop it.
We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KNBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
This is your last chance to sign up for the Enterprise Leadership Network's November Executive Forum. It will be held next Monday and Tuesday, November 13th and 14th at the Monterey Plaza Hotel. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity to talk to and meet with top executives about issues of cybersecurity, electronic discovery, and more. Be there along with many other top flight folks from around the country and beyond. To sign up, go to eln3.com. See you there.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're having discussions with Joe Weiss. Joe is an old school control systems guy who worked on control systems for the first half of his career and ended up in cybersecurity by accident, as usual.
The two projects I worked on when I was in nuclear that have the most relevance to what we're talking about today. And when I say today, I'm talking about a blog I just put out October 4th at, you know, 8:30 in the morning. Okay.
Well, we'll just leave the date out of it earlier today, because whatever day this airs, you will probably have put out a blog that morning too.
Yeah, maybe. But the point is, so what happened was two things. One, I started mentioning before, was the sensor issue, that we were trying to extend calibration intervals and do predictive maintenance of the sensors. We sensor health monitoring.
Yeah, by the way, this is not what they meant in our early physics class when they said that, you know, you can't measure anything without affecting the system, right? Which is also true. But in this case, the device doing the measurement is smashing the system. It's just a much more macro version of anything you measure is going to also affect the system.
For example, if you have, you know, for measuring flow, you have devices that you will put in the pipe deliberately to cause a flow restriction, an orifice.
Yeah, in order to measure it, sure.
And what you're measuring.
I don't know if you know this, Joe, but Monterey is like the world's leading place for flow monitoring and measurement and valves.
Yeah. I mean, when I was running, and again, I can go into more detail. I didn't know that at the time. So I actually went to NIST flow measurement lab to try to figure out why we weren't seeing certain things. But the point I wanted to get across is that this project we had going on at EPRI to extend calibration intervals and also to do sensor health monitoring. In the nuclear industry, if you're going to do anything to change existing safety requirements, you have to do a very detailed safety analysis to convince the NRC that you have not introduced.
You used initials.
Oh, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you.
To convince the FRC.
Anyways, that you haven't, if you will, reduce the safety margin or cause the plant to be less safe. Okay. So as long as you can say, hey, we haven't caused the plant to be less safe.
All right, but how can you do that, Joe? Because there's unanticipated consequences.
Well, this is where this was coming from. So I'm doing this analysis. My colleague is doing this sensor health project. And this was being done at the Millstone 2 nuclear plant in Connecticut. Okay. This was the only nuclear unit, not plant, but even unit in the world that was actually collecting sensor data at the time. And it was strictly because of this project we were doing at EPRI, which I already defined.
So, hang on a second. So certainly there were other experimental nuclear facilities around the country that were measuring things.
Not collecting the detailed sensor data. That's
so so they were measuring it all the time and using it for monitoring and feedback, but they weren't actually collecting it for later analysis.
Right. Because remember, we're talking in this is late 80s, early 90s. Okay.
You know, my uncle ran an experimental nuclear reactor at Penn State University.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so they had all the controls in place, but you're saying that they just weren't collecting all that data over time.
We're looking at the actual sensor, detailed sensor data. Okay. People were doing was collecting more upstream. The motors are reading or the valves are reading or, you know, all of that.
After analysis or, you know, periodic measurements, but not at the actual sensor level.
Because
people don't necessarily understand that at the sensor, you know, the sensor itself might be measuring some physical thing, but that gets turned into some electronic signal for transmission. And that electronic signal reflects maybe a digitization, or even if it's analog, at some point it has to get digitized if you're going to store it other than on a continuous tape, right? So you're talking about the actual stuff happening at the device as opposed to the downstream information you're collecting at a control center.
Correct. In other words, this is dealing with the movement of, you know, the data reflecting the movement of a diaphragm or,
When we're recording this, right, we're recording the output of the microphone in a digitized form, but the actual microphone has an actual diagram that's moving. So you're talking about measuring the diaphragm, not just the sound coming out.
Exactly, because you know what we were trying to do in terms of sensor health is we thought the movement of the diaphragm would have some relationship or relevance to, if you will, the degradation of the health. And so we were looking at, hey, if we do this, we have a way of saying, do we still trust the sensor, or when do we need to do something about it? Do you follow?
So in this time frame, Joe, you weren't the only one doing this sort of thing in that time frame. You were the only one doing it for nuclear plants. But
correct.
But there's a whole revolution that took place in anticipating failures, right? And this is actually widely used today now in home systems, for example. They have these power measurement systems that they're putting into homes that can detect when your refrigerator is going to go bad because it's taking more power than it normally does to run the pump. And that says that the pump's going bad. It's not bad yet, but it's going bad. And they can even predict when it's going to fail so they can do the replacement without you losing everything in the refrigerator.
This is exactly what we were trying to do in the late 80s, early 90s. And this was part of that process, okay? Well, what happened was, as Murphy would have it, the NRC...
You said Murphy. Now you got to tell us all about Murphy's Law.
Oh, okay. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong, and it won't go wrong in the way you thought it was going to go wrong.
Yeah, the common expression is whatever can go wrong will go wrong in the worst possible way.
Yes. So in this case, it actually was, in our sense, in the best possible way, because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had put out an information notice. This is a formal notice put out by NRC. Of, and if you will, a safety-related incident that the industry should be aware of. And in this case, it was a failure of a pressure sensor at Millstone 2. So that's what I'm saying. When I said Murphy, this is almost the flip side. If this would have been anywhere else in the world but Millstone 2, nobody would have been able to figure anything else about it.
But it happened to be right where you were doing this recording.
It just happened to be, okay? And so when we started looking at the data, nothing made sense as to what the failure could have been. It just, like I say, we had the data, and the data just, so what
the data didn't correlate to the failure. Wild guess, what you determined was that the failure was caused by the sensor.
Yeah, okay, but it was the why or what of that sensor failure, okay? Now, in this case, this was a Rosemont, which is the name of a sensor company. It's now owned by Emerson. This is called an 1151. That's the model number, which is the most popular pressure sensor in the world, not just for nuclear, but for everywhere, okay? And it's a diaphragm-based sensor. So what happens is the diaphragm moves as the pressure increases or decreases. And you get a capacitance signal, and it's converted by the electronics into a pressure or differential pressure signal.
Okay. Yeah, so just so everybody knows about the capacitance signal here. So that diaphragm is in parallel with something else. It's moving relative to some other surface.
Correct.
And you put charge, a positive charge on one of the surfaces, a negative on the other one. And as they move closer and further away, the capacitance changes, and you can measure the capacitance by sending a frequency through it, and you see how much that frequency gets changed, how much the voltage or the current changes, and that's a function of the frequency and the capacitance.
Correct.
You can then calculate the movement of the diaphragm, and that tells you the differential in pressure based on the physics of the diagram and how much pressure it is causing it to move how far. So
perfect. Now,
quick course in capacitive diaphragm measurement technology.
And the point being, there is a small fill of fluid, if you will, oil that's in there that allows that diaphragm to push against that plate. Okay. Now, what people thought initially is if the diaphragm would have a problem with respect to the oil leaking out, it would be a large break. All of the oil would go out, and the sensor, this is a what's called a 4 to 20 milliamp sensor. So it would peg either down at 4 milliamps, say at zero, or 20 milliamps at, say, 100%.
Yeah, minimum or maximum, yeah. But and that's not what happened. It wasn't leaking at that rate. It was leaking at a different rate. So it didn't peg. Instead, it was just moving.
Well,
and so they were measuring the ends instead of the middle, right?
Right. And what happened was, in this case, it was a small, small leak. So now, we didn't know any of this at the time. This is what we learned over time. And what we learned was, what caused it was a manufacturing flaw at the vendor. We're talking about a hardware supply chain issue now.
Yeah, this is like the O-rings, right? On one of the space shuttles, right?
Like,
yeah, or like Apollo 13, right? Where, you know, 2 years before, some manufacturing process had a minor flaw that ended up, you know, blowing the whole thing
up. Right? That's by the way, that's exactly the point, because if the flaw would have been quote unquote big and fatal, that was the assumption. And when that happened, you would see it right away. And the fact that a sensor fails is not a problem, as long as the sensor fails in an obvious way.
Yeah, you can tell it's failed and you can ignore it, use another sensor or what have you. Yeah.
All of this
has to do with the interdependency analysis. And for the most part, people don't carry those out in digital systems, right?
Well, don't forget, this was an analog system, much less digital.
I know. I'm just saying that, the lesson in the analog world is the same in the digital world, except in the digital world, we don't even think about that stuff until
correct.
Way later.
Absolutely. So what happened here was, in a sense, the worst of all worlds.
It's not the worst of all worlds because we're still here.
Yeah, in that case, yes, we are. But certain facilities aren't. So what happened was, because now, and this was the response of the sensor was a function of how much oil was in there. So assuming it still had any type of reasonable amount of oil, if you were at a steady state condition, the sensor would be reading normally. You would have no reason to think there's any problem at all. The problem was, if there was any type of transient or upset condition, it was a function of how much oil was still in as to how accurate or what the response of that sensor would be.
Yeah, if there's less oil, then there's less motion produced by the larger condition that's happening in the plant.
So the reason I was getting involved is I was worried about the instantaneous response for safety reasons, because the regulatory requirement for these sensors, because the safety analysis was all built on how fast the sensors respond, because that would be how fast the safety systems would actuate, which would be, you know, the level of safety you'd provide. Okay.
Yeah, there's a time requirement for response times. Otherwise, these systems get out of control and go crazy.
And
right?
What happened here was, while losing oil, their response time started increasing, and it was a function of how much oil was lost.
Yeah, so the more that's lost, the slower your response and less able you are to keep the thing in the control zone it has to stay in.
Correct.
Eventually, you get to the point where it was out of the envelope of desired control, and then things went bad quickly and worse because it was too slow.
Or didn't respond at all.
Well, that would be much slower.
Yes.
That's too slow.
That right. is too slow.
You know, the world doesn't have enough popcorn for listening to you to debate these things. You know, folks, you got a picture of this show. Fred and Joe are God's own engineers. I mean, these are guys who will, you know, debate it down to the atomic level if necessary without batting an eye. But, you know, what you guys are talking about, you know, as a kid, I remember looking up, you know, looking forward into the future and looking up in the sky, you know, and thinking, you know, how long am I going to live? You know, we need to have spaceships, you know, get up to these stars and so forth before we could ever really see them and know about them and everything else. And we didn't know other planets existed, right? This is when we had 9 or arguably 8 known planets in the universe. And what we've done is just stare harder and harder and harder at the same patch of sky. Stare harder because all the information's there. And like Joe's saying, you know, in these systems, right? You know, as he pointed out, right? You know, a motor starts going bad, it starts using more power. That information is right there in every electrical system out there right now. If you had that information, you could avoid like losing the food in your fridge or having your factory shut down or, right? So it ends up being inevitable that we can at some point use that information that's already there just by staring at the same stuff harder, we will.
Which brings up the issue of covert channels.
Oh, yeah. Hold my coffee, right?
Yeah. It's the same thing, right? The closer you stare, the more information you can get out of it, until you get out the information that they don't want you to get. And so there's this battle between not letting you know what we don't want you to know and making sure you can know what we wish you knew. And it's a lose-lose situation. Which brings me my article. Go ahead.
Well, again, this is why I love all this stuff so much, because it is an engineering discipline, but it's applied to the real world. So you're always find yourself, you know, bound by economics, time, you know, logistics or whatever to come up with things that actually work. So yeah, you can bury data in and you can get data out of anything. You'd be just amazed, folks. It's awesome. It's a lot of fun.
I think the fundamental limit is the willingness to sit there and have Joe and I discuss it for another 10 seconds. I was trying to speed him up, but he keeps bringing up things that have to be explained, so I have to explain them, you know, and now he's, you know, and every explanation is going to go deeper. It's like, oh, no. All right, so this brings me to the article that I wrote. I was at the Inter-Paris Trust meeting last week in Vancouver, British Columbia, with fantastic people from all around the world talking about trust in digital records, and in particular, the use of artificial intelligence in archives and records management, and the ability to trust what that artificial intelligence does. So in that meeting, talking about leaking information, one of the computer science graduate students said, and I'm going to try not to misquote him, we can use a federated model. If you take the model and don't bring out the data, the model doesn't reveal anything about the data. So you can federate the model between two. And I'm like, no, no, no. But, you know, these people are not steeped in cybersecurity, so they don't understand at a fundamental level. So, and this, it's written up in the article, but it's more fun to talk about it. The article is sort of a little bit slow at it. So what happened was, at the end of this section of the meeting, I said, anybody that buys into this notion that a federated model doesn't leak secrets, meet me in the corner. Now, when I said that, it was interpreted like somebody that said, you know, if you don't believe that, you know, we're going to meet in the alley behind the bar, you know, and fight it out. Okay. So we go into the corner and four or five folks come over. And so I said, you know, I like to find the simple question. I said, when you federate this model, and these models are these representations you use in AI, these large language models that generate the output when you ask them the question. There's a technology that implements the model. But what I said was, okay, so when you federate the model from the classified stuff with the unclassified stuff, do the answers change? And they said, yes. And I said, okay, then information leaks. And they, So why would you federate them if it didn't change the output, obviously? Okay, so that was obvious. But then I got the retort. And he said, basically he said, yeah, but I don't know how I could get that information out. And I said, just because you don't know doesn't mean somebody else won't eventually figure it out. Okay, so that was the end of that. That was mildly accepted. Okay, so later on in the day, I'm thinking about how would I get the information out. And I thought of a story. And the next morning, I go back to the meeting and I tell the story. And this is one of those meetings where they're very organized and you know you have to really reserve your time in advance, but I didn't have any time reserved. However, somebody was having difficulty setting up the projector. So while they were setting up the projector, everybody's waiting. So I said, while you're setting up the projector, let me, and so I said, okay, I have a really good example for you. You take all of the written material from all of humanity prior to 1940. Every bit of it, every story in every language everywhere, and you put it into a model and you analyze that model as much as you reasonably can or want to. Okay, that's your first model. Now I'm going to take a model from classified information on nuclear weapons. and I'm going to derive a model from that. And then we're going to combine those models together. Now, how do you imagine I could get the information out from that classified model? How about if I ask anything about nuclear weapons? You know, clearly, whatever it says is not going to be from the pre-1940 history of the world. And then I said, you know, because this is where the group is, I said, well, now, you know, previously we were talking about the same thing with, you know, confidential information about people in the university context. So let's take that model and federate that in and ask about class, you know, about the information about people in the university context. And, you know, because it's not part of the nuclear secrets, presumably, and it's not part of the history of the world before then, you're going to get more information. And then I said, now the folks over at the bank, suppose we then fused in the bank information about how you're managing accounts, you know. And so that was sort of the end of the discussion. But the point being that stuff leaks, right? Almost anything you can think of it's going to leak. The presumption should never be that because I don't know how doesn't mean somebody else can't figure it out.
Right, which takes you into the whole consequence-driven approach to things. You know, so if this information leaked, what does that mean? Right, and work backwards from there. Because if it means, you know, embarrassment, it means one thing. If it means the end of your company, it means another thing. It means the end of your country or your life or whatever. You know, and we all do this in everyday life, right? We manage information relatively well, or at least well enough, you know, that we on average all get through our lives. But again, to the point, you know, that you and Joe were really talking about, or that topic, right? You know, is all this information just embedded in the systems, right? And I think this is true in everything cybernetics. I think it's true in everything business, right? You know, if you look at it harder, you know, actually scope it out. You know, what does that take to get that information? I think about this with Argotera, with our electric boats. You know, I want to see how much power literally motors are using. I want to know what that is on average. I want to know what the patterns are in spikes depending on usage. And I want to know when it slowly starts going up over time, because that means that motor is going to be replaced at some point in the predictable future. And it's such a almost ham-fisted example, but there's so much data like that in there when you just keep looking at it.
I think what's even more important from the standpoint of what you're doing is you're running research vessels. And when you go to implement it in the day-to-day operations, you know, it's very important that you not put in the wrong motor, or that you be able to detect it before they get caught in the middle of a storm, unable to move, and so on and so forth. And on the research vessels, that's when you get to try things. And so when you track it in the research arena, you have to look typically much more deeply, because you don't yet know what's going to be the key thing to look at. But once you've looked at it enough and you know what the key thing is out in the field, then you can save a lot of time and effort and money in analysis in many cases by only looking at the things that are important to that field execution.
Well, and the value too, like, explain this to folks a little bit, right? So with Augatera, we have smart self-powered boats that use swarming behavior to do things and produce a lot of data. And the swarming behavior part of it is interesting. It's what we're doing with the research vessels in the over this winter and the spring, where, you know, two vessels going opposite directions have different power needs. You know, one is going with the wind, has the batteries are fully charged, doesn't need any more, its life is easy. The other one's going into the conditions, it needs more power than it can have. Now, you can make bigger boats. You can just add more solar panels, add more hulls, add more square footage, get the power balance that way. Or you can have, you know, smaller boats that serve the same purpose, that share power via a third boat, you know, that goes and charges itself at one and discharges at another one. And all of these little bits come down to how much CapEx you have to spend to build your equipment. It's not just...
All right, hang on. Now you've done it. CapEx.
How much capital expense? Yeah, so do you need a 50-foot piece of equipment, or will a 30-foot piece of equipment do the same job? I'll tell you one thing, the 30-foot piece of equipment, you know, could be a lot cheaper. And maybe you could have two of those or three.
So capital expense versus operating expense, CapEx versus OpEx, right, are the trade-offs you're talking about. So just, you know, we use these abbreviations like everybody knows.
Right. Yeah. But again, you know, this is not a fad, right? You know, Joe has been doing this for a long time. You know, this has been going on for thousands of years and making systems more efficient. And so much of the cybernetics value of the world we're in right now is not being able to control the actuators. It's that data. It's being able to nuance enough information out of the data, you know, you can have that exists inside your own equipment, whatever kind of operation you're running, to have more efficient stuff, smaller, lighter stuff. You know, it's anyway.
Yeah, there's one other comment I want to make, and that is, Joe said it was just the sheerest of luck. It just happened that we were watching it when this happened. But I'd be willing to bet it happens all over the place all the time. And anywhere you were watching closely enough, you would have seen it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the value of sensor data, you know, out here in the water, the coral reef restoration, read an article this morning, quoting David Vaughn, who in 2019 I talked to when he was still at Moat Marine Labs. And most people know of the coral reef emergency we have around the world. And David is one of the folks, you know, he's got a microfragmentation replantation nonprofit that's moving things forward, right? You know, so it's been 4 years when we first discussed the idea of gathering all this data for that purpose, you know, from vessels that are already there, that again, already have that data, you know, their hulls, you know, felt, you know, the water, you know, they went right through it. They just didn't record the data. So what does it cost to get the data? If it's low, and in our case, it's near zero, the value of getting that data, you know, can, you know, power orders of magnitude, you know, increase its value.
Just as a side note, you know, having come from the, you know, the session on archives and records management, it's not just the getting of the data, it's the transport and storage and retention and disposition and everything else you have to do with it over time that actually I think drives the expense. But when that collection side gets sufficiently efficient, the rest of the infrastructure becomes the limitation. And that's what we have today with IoT. Right? We've got gobs of cameras, gobs of, you know, so, and this is wonderful, right? So when there's an investigation related to a shooting or something, they start to look at every camera in the area and say, oh, you know, give us your cell phones, give us your webcams, you know, what is it? Give us your tired, your hungry, your poor. Give us your cell phones, your webcams, your doorbells, right? And with that, you know, they track the movement of people as they change clothes, change cars, you know, put on masks, all the movement of people. And it, some of these studies are fantastic and amazing, like the Israeli assassins that got caught, I guess, in Qatar, having gone through, you know, changes of clothing and masking and everything else. They figured out that they had done this by looking at that sequence of changes over time. That's the first time I saw that so widely published. But now it's just common practice, right? I mean, if you don't do that in police work today, you're not doing your job.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, in the supply chain world, you know, it's fascinating having these conversations with you and, you know, listen to our friends and think about their thoughts as we go through this in the U.S. federal government Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, software bill of materials sharing working groups that I'm co-chairing has in an interesting spot right now where we're just defining these three types of actors. And Fred, you're, you know, touching on one of them, the most interesting one that today's call and subgroup calls this week, you know, are just trying to work out that role in the middle. I'm a distributor of this information. I mean, in this case, you know, software contents, you know, your software inventory, but in a supply chain context, how do I get that if I bought a product to build a solution and the product manufacturer bought subcomponents from somebody that bought chips from somebody else that had software on them using a library, you know, how do I put all of this together in any amount of time that actually does me any bloody good? And
yeah, which brings us to Paradata. So I'm one of the things I'm working on with other folks at InterParis Trust is the Paradata study group. And the Paradata, you know, metadata is like the date and time and all that stuff associated with the creation of a record, the sort of stuff that you have electronically in most computer systems. But the Paradata is sort of the everything else. That's the how do I actually reconstruct the bloody thing. And so the Paradata group, and then during the larger event that I was at, I started to mention SBOM, you know, software bill of materials, and it turns out that they weren't yet aware of it. So I said, aha, software bill of materials, write that down. Digital bill of materials, write that down. And so I think you're going to be getting a call before too long, and you may end up participating in InterParis Trust. So, hey, there's, you know, there's no limit to the threads that go out from these interesting developments that we do, but there is a limit to how much time we can spend talking about them.
That's right.
Well, this is your last chance to sign up for the Enterprise Leadership Network's November Executive Forum. It will be held Monday and Tuesday, November 13th and 14th. That's next Monday and Tuesday at the Monterey Plaza Hotel. As you've heard in today's show, AI from around the world is proclaiming the tremendous value of the event. Don't miss this outstanding opportunity to talk to and meet with top executives about issues of cybersecurity, electronic discovery, and more. To sign up, go to eln3.com and click on Join Now. Or, of course, you can always go there from thecybershow.co. I will be there, and so should you. Be there or be square. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Joe versus the political volcano. Watch out for the Dilbert date. Mark works hundreds of cases and gets comfortable with testifying. ELN ends out the year and starts a new one with AI, games, and pitchers. More fraud, spies, and lies for the holiday season, breaking news, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string-beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.